From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Alice Siebold about her novel The Lovely Bones. It's probably the most acclaimed novel of the season, appearing on a lot of critics' top 10 lists. The story is about a 14-year-old girl who is raped and murdered, then goes to heaven and observes how her family is changed by her death. Siebold is also the author of the memoir Lucky, about her own experience of rape. Also, the film Glengarry Glen Ross is coming out on DVD. We'll talk with two of the men who worked on the movie, director James Foley and actor Alan Arkin. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. With Mississippi's Trent Lott stepping down as Republican leader of the Senate, the leading candidate to replace him appears to be Tennessee Senator Bill Frist, the chamber's only physician. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
A former heart-lung transplant surgeon, Frist had never run for office before winning his seat in an upset in 1994. This year, he helped Republicans win back a majority as head of the Senate's GOP campaign committee. Frist has made the most of his medical expertise since joining the Senate. He's helped draft a wide range of public health bills, including a bipartisan measure to fight potential bioterrorism. He's also been a Republican point man on more partisan issues, including a patient's bill of rights and Medicare reform. Frist has also had his share of missteps. During the Senate's anthrax attacks last year, he downplayed the dangers of transmitting the bacteria through the mail. And he drafted a controversial provision included in the new Homeland Security law granting liability protection to the drug company Eli Lilly. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Senate Republicans are expected to hold elections for a new leader on Monday. In a Christmas message to British soldiers today, Prime Minister Tony Blair told troops to prepare for possible war with Iraq. The Prime Minister apologized to troops for the uncertainty over whether a war would occur. NPR's Guy Raz reports from London.
Tony Blair implied that military action would only take place after consultations with the United Nations at the end of January.
The key thing at the moment is to make all the preparations necessary and to make sure that we're building up the capacity in the region, both the Americans, ourselves, and making sure that we're able to undertake this mission if it falls to us to do so.
Earlier this week, Downing Street ordered several cargo ships packed with military equipment to head toward the Gulf region. On Wednesday, British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw said Iraq's 12,000-page weapons declaration included, quote, obvious falsehoods. The U.S. and Britain have indicated that if Iraq is found in material breach of U.N. disarmament resolutions, military action could follow. Guy Raz, NPR News, London.
President Bush has postponed a planned trip to Africa next month. The White House cites the standoff with Iraq and the president's desire to work on domestic issues. Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said today the trip will be reset for later in the year. It would be Mr. Bush's first visit to the African continent. French authorities say they have arrested four Islamic militants planning one or more terror attacks in Europe. The arrests were the latest in a widening French dragnet of terror suspects ahead of the holidays. Stocks lunged ahead today on positive economic news, settlement of brokerage house conflict of interest charges, and Trent Lott's resignation as Senate Majority Leader. The Dow Industrials closed up 147 points to 85.12. The Nasdaq was up 9. This is NPR News. The Palestinian Elections Committee today formally recommended Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat postpone next month's vote. The committee said elections cannot be held while Israeli troops remain in most Palestinian cities. NPR's Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
Election Committee Chairman Hanna Nasser said the committee today met with Arafat and recommended that he postpone the election. Nasser said the committee places full responsibility on Israel for not being able to make the required preparations to conduct a proper and democratic election. Israeli troops are stationed in all Palestinian cities except Jericho, and Palestinians' freedom of movement is severely curtailed. It is now up to Arafat to decide whether the elections will be postponed. Israeli elections are due to be held on January 28th. Also today, Israeli police said they defused a large bomb near a crowded shopping mall in the coastal town of Netanya. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
President Bush said today the Mideast Roadmap peace plan is not ready yet, but said the administration is committed to its completion. American, Russian, and European Union diplomats, members of the so-called quartet with the United Nations, met today at the White House and State Department to work on the plan. It advocates a Palestinian state separate from Israel. Boeing says it is canceling plans for its proposed high-speed Sonic Cruiser passenger jet. Instead, the company says it will build a more traditional and highly fuel-efficient airliner. A Boeing spokesman today estimated eventual sales of 2,000 to 3,000 of the fuel-efficient mid-sized jet. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the James Irvine Foundation, supporting NPR's West Coast expansion, www.irvine.org, partners in building a better California.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Alice Siebold, is the author of the novel The Lovely Bones, which has been on the New York Times bestseller list for nearly 6 months. Time magazine described it as the breakout fiction debut of the year. The story is about the rape, murder, and mutilation of a 14-year-old girl. Our own book critic, Maureen Corrigan, said the subject matter made her reluctant to pick up the book, but reading it gave her a singular, disturbing, and even enlightening literary experience. The author, Alice Siebold, is also the author of Lucky, a memoir in which she recounts being raped when she was a college freshman. The Lovely Bones begins with an attack on the young teen, who is raped, tortured, and killed. The rest of the novel is narrated from heaven, with the girl observing her family and friends as they try to carry on after her death. Terry spoke with Alice Siebold this summer.
I'm sure a lot of listeners are wondering why write about something so horrible, so unthinkable, the rape and dismemberment of a 14-year-old girl.
Because it's part of life. You know, that's the simplest answer, I think, for me. It's very much part of the experience of what it is to live in this culture. It happens all the time.
Now, you were raped yourself when you were a freshman in college, and that's a subject of an earlier book you wrote, a memoir. And reading those two books back to back, I was really struck by the difference in the descriptions of the rape. The rape, as you describe it in your memoir, is very brutal, very detailed in its brutality. It's as if you're reliving every moment and describing it like a journalist.
Mm-hmm. I think they are very different books in my mind, even though they both not only have violence but start out in violence. One of them is factual, and I tell every detail in some way in the memoir, and the other one is a fictive voice, and there's so much more being given in the first chapter of The Lovely Bones in terms of getting to know her character and some of the facts of her family and her background.
I got the impression that the kind of moment-by-moment description of the brutality that's in your memoir is something you felt didn't belong in this new novel, in the description of the brutality that this 14-year-old faces.
Yeah, the funny thing is that I did write the beginning of The Lovely Bones before I wrote my memoir. So Susie's, the violent crime that occurs in Susie's life happened in terms of writing about it before a description of my own rape was written by me later. I think in order to separate the two stories to make sure that Susie was not doing any of my work for me when I returned to the novel, I stopped to write Lucky. And one of the things that it was very important for me to do was to get all the facts down of my own case. So they had been written, they existed whole in a whole nother book, and I could go back to Susie and she could lead me where she wanted to take me and tell me her story in the way she wanted to tell it, as opposed to me feeling perhaps that I needed to really tell the real deal about every detail about rape and violence. I did that in the memoir as opposed to the novel. Because I wanted my characters to rule the novel, not some sort of desire to talk about rape and reveal rape to readers.
Your memoir ends, "I live in a world where the two truths coexist, where both hell and hope live in the palm of my hand." Is that in a way where your novel picks up with hell and hope or hell and heaven being side by side?
Definitely. I mean, that's one of my major motivations in terms of how I live my life. And also, though, why I see fiction as so incredibly important is to be able to give, in a very short space, the context for those two things coexisting and coexisting in an honest way, where hope is really springing out of something that was is hard won, as opposed to purchased in the, you know, how to cope section at the local bookstore.
After Susie is raped and killed and mutilated, and this is in the first chapter, she goes to heaven, and the rest of the story is narrated by her as she experiences this part of heaven and looks down on her family and neighbors as they go on without her. What interested you in this idea of your narrator being in heaven looking down on the people she's had to leave behind?
I think I needed to find a way, and first I have to say that, again, when Susie's voice presented it to me, she presented completely, and she was already in heaven. So that was something, when I got to the end of the first 15 pages, which I did not know was going to be the first chapter of a novel, I had my character, I had where she was, and I had what had happened to her. And because she was such a bossy main character, I had no choice. I had to follow her. So though it was not conscious a choice to place her in heaven, once I realized that she had put me there in some way, it is a position from which she can tell a story to a reader and bring a reader to places that they wouldn't have access on. And that she wouldn't have access on unless she were in heaven. And to see, referring back to the previous question about heaven and hope or hope and hell, all those things, to see those things put together in a context that is ultimately in some way horrible but doesn't have to be so threatening that readers are afraid to read about the truth or about the reality that a girl like Susie would experience.
Can you describe the heaven that you've created for Susie?
It's a heaven with what I'd say is a lot of open spaces. It was much more detailed in early drafts of the book, and it was an experience in creating where I wrote much more than ultimately remained, knowing what to take away so that people can bring their own ideas of things into the heaven that remains. There's something probably strangely like the open fields of suburbia about the heaven that Susie inhabits, because in the book, the heaven would reflect a bit of what the person had experienced or known on Earth. There are also silly things like the textbooks that she has are 17 in vogue, because that, in her case, as a 14-year-old girl, would be a textbook that she'd want to have. And then there are other things that are not, say, fun or familiar. And those are the things to try to figure out how to rectify the situation that she's in and look at the people on Earth and see them really suffering, and how to cope and understand herself with that as they are coping and understanding with her loss on Earth.
You write about the burden of guilt on the parents in the novel. Susie says about her father, "Every day he got up, before sleep wore off, he was who he used to be. Then as his consciousness woke, it was as if poison seeped in. At first he couldn't even get up. He lay there under a heavy weight, the guilt on him, the hand of God pressing down on him, saying, 'You were not there when your daughter needed you.'" Do you want to talk a little bit about the guilt you imagine the parents feeling?
It's an interesting thing. Some of the father was another character for me in the novel that was there very quickly, very immediately, and he really, to me, is the heart of the family. I think, particularly with a sexual assault crime, whether the victim, if the victim is a child, whether it's a male or a female child, fathers often feel extremely responsible for what happens in that way to their children. They want to be able to fix it very, very much and go out and do something. And it has become somewhat stereotypical in movies and television that the father wants to go and catch or kill the perpetrator. But the truth is that it's a stereotype that reflects reality. In my own experience, I can count the number of times that, both my father, but also boyfriends, male friends, particularly would say things like, you know, I want to kill the bastard. Just in this desire to do something, and also to great shame because the perpetrator is male. And for the mother in The Lovely Bones, it throws her into a whole reevaluation of what her life has been about. Obviously, there have been problems with her understanding of its value before this. But then in the loss of her daughter, it throws her again into this questioning about what she's done with her life and whether it was actually indeed what she wanted to do with it.
Our guest is Alice Siebold, author of the best-selling novel The Lovely Bones. She'll talk more with Terry after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Alice Siebold, author of the novel The Lovely Bones. It's the story of a 14-year-old girl who is raped and murdered, then goes to heaven where she observes her family trying to carry on without her. Siebold is also the author of Lucky, a 1999 memoir about being raped. She spoke with Terry this summer.
After you were raped, when you were trying to figure out what you were doing with your life and dealing with all the wounds that this rape left you with, psychological and physical, were you at the same time watching your parents dealing with a different set of wounds caused by the same rape?
Definitely, particularly my mother, I think. You know, it just hits the entire family like a ton of bricks. And trauma is, especially when it's a trauma that is not a well-known trauma for those traumas that are well-known, really, there's so much to try to understand. I remember watching television, say, with my sister after the rape when I was just basically lying on the couch and trying to recover. And if anything came on that made her maybe think about violence or whatever, she would stare back at me, and it made me highly self-conscious. But she was deeply trying to understand what my experience had been. And I think one of my motivations for writing my own book, and certainly also a motivation for writing the novel, is the desire to just put it out there on the table. This is what a rape can look like. And if people maybe know more about it, then the victim's not as alienated, nor is the victim's family. And nor are people who live across the street as afraid of saying something really stupid, because maybe they're more educated about what the crime is.
Now, you said earlier that it was only after writing the beginning of your novel, The Lovely Bones, that you decided to go back and write a memoir about your rape. And you said it was because you wanted to, like, tell your own story so that your own story wasn't superimposed on your character's story. I'm interested in how your memory functioned of mm-hmm. the incident, because, you know, when after something that's about as traumatic as it gets happens to you, on the one hand, you really want to forget it so that it's not obsessing you and haunting you all the time. On the other hand, I suppose in a lot of ways you don't want to lose the memories that have been recorded so that you can continue to comprehend the experience. So did you find that you had like vivid memories of it, vivid enough to write an almost journalistic account of it? Or did you have to work to regain memories that you had tried to forget?
I would say my memory for the rape itself and the incidents surrounding the rape, like the trial, was better 5 to 7 years after the actual event, even up to 10, than it was in the first 3 or 4 years afterwards. You know, I very directly went into therapy right after the rape, all miserable experiences. And then I didn't do anything like that for about the next 10 years. And I found a lovely therapist who had the, you know, uniqueness of being free in New York and worked with her. But one of the things that was the funniest thing for me is that I had written an article for the New York Times Sunday Magazine about rape and had been quoted in a book called Trauma and Recovery, which is an excellent book. And I bought it because I'd been such a miserable failure as a writer in my 20s that it was one of the few places I had appeared in print. And on the subway home with the book, I realized that I was quoted in the first half, which was called Trauma, instead of the second half, which was called Recovery. And that strangely inspired me to read the whole book. And by the time I got to the end of the book, I realized that I had post-traumatic stress disorder and went from there. So only after, I'd say, a full 10 years away from the rape was I able to face the rape and deal with the clear memories of it. Luckily, one of the things I did right after the rape, because I was a kind of a, you know, morbid poetic kid, was write verbatim accounts of exactly what had happened to me physically and what the light had been like and things like that in a journal of mine.
What did you do with the journal? Did you lock it up and put it away?
It was in my parents' basement the whole time I lived in New York. So I, you know, that's when you just love your parents for having a waterlogged, messy basement.
So the book was, the journal was still readable?
Yeah, the journal was readable, yeah.
And what was the experience of opening up the journal after a period of years had elapsed and reading it in the voice that you had a few years ago, reading the description?
I would say it was mind-blowing for a couple of reasons, and not the least of which was to realize what I had actually experienced. Because I think while you're going through it, you just, especially if you have the chance of going through a trial, which I did, you need to keep your eye on the ball. You need to be focused. You can't really drift off into maximum pain. So to go back and look at the accounts of what was actually happening, you know, I have to say, I just thought like, hey, kid, you did okay.
You were already interested in writing when you were raped. You were a freshman in college. Later in college, you were studying with the poet Tess Gallagher.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the assignments she gave you after she realized about this trauma in your life was to write a poem that started, If They Caught You.
Right.
I could see you responding one of two ways to that. One way to go, oh, give me a break, and the other to actually write a great poem. tell us what your response was to that.
I think with Tess, who was one of those teachers, I mean, I have taught and I have had wonderful teachers, and I believe that atmosphere, particularly for those students who are going through anything traumatic, can be an incredible atmosphere. And Tess did not shy away from dealing with a student who I'm sure a lot of people just thought, like, eek, keep her away from me. She might explode on me. She forced my hand on that. I had written a vague kind of poem about rape. We had a discussion in her office. She asked me if it were based on anything that had actually happened to me in my life. I told her, and then she suggested that. I admired her greatly as a poet. She was an extremely empathetic teacher, and out of that, I decided, okay, she's forcing me to do something. It feels a little weird, but it was a great thing to do. So, and they caught him a week later. So who knows? There was a little magic in that assignment.
People often wonder if writing is therapeutic. If you're writing about a trauma, does that help the pain of the trauma recede? I mean, Susie in the novel says something about, I forget exactly what she says, but it's something like every time she tells her story, like a drop of the pain goes away.
Right.
But as a writer yourself who's written about your own trauma and then written a mm-hmm. fictionalized version of a similar trauma, is writing therapeutic, or do you think that that's really the wrong way to approach it anyways?
My feeling, and it's pretty, rigorous is that therapy is for therapy, and that writing can be therapeutic, but therapeutic writing should not be published. My job as a writer is to go through the therapy myself, and if I manage to get through it and I feel I have something to share from that, to share it with my audience or my readers. But I don't write novels and seek to have them published so that I can get therapy from having written them. That's really the responsibility of an individual to do outside the context of their published work.
Writers usually have to have some kind of empathy and understanding of each of their characters, the good guys and the bad guys. Do you feel like in your novel you had to have empathy for the rapist, who's a man from the neighborhood? He's a man that the family knows.
Definitely. I mean, in my own personal belief, you can't write a good character unless you have both compassion and respect for them. So Mr. Harvey, who is the killer in the book, yes, I have great compassion for him. There are moments where he attempts to try to do things other than what his driver's instinct is telling him to do, by counting things obsessively or building things. So he resists up until the point where he's no longer able to resist. And, you know, that is, you can have compassion without forgiveness. And I think that's what I would say.
Were you able to find that kind of compassion for the man who raped you?
I would say eventually, certainly not immediately. But, you know, we're all born into this world in very different ways, and we have different experiences of it. And I don't know a lot about him, but some of the things I do know led me to feel compassion for him. There are also many people who had much more worse circumstances than he did that have managed not to go out and rape people. But that doesn't mean you can't have compassion for them. I don't forgive him, but, you know, he's a human being. You have to move on. You know, it's just as simple as that. And so you find a way to move on, and having compassion for people just in general is a good way to live in life.
Well, Alice Siebold, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alice Siebold is the author of the novel The Lovely Bones. She's also the author of a 1999 memoir called Lucky.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of A Singular Hostage, a novel set in 19th century India by Thalassa Ali. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, director James Foley and actor Alan Arkin talk about working on the film Glengarry Glen Ross. The 1992 movie is coming out on DVD. It's about a group of men working in a real estate office, enduring cutthroat conditions in order to survive. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. David Mamet's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Glengarry Glen Ross, was adapted for the screen in 1992. Mamet wrote the screenplay, and James Foley directed the movie. It's taken 10 years for that film to be released on DVD, but it's been worth the wait. Glengarry Glen Ross is about a group of men selling bad real estate to broke customers. These guys are very persuasive and persistent, with a bag of verbal tricks to get customers to buy. They also use their techniques on their boss and on each other to try to get the best customers or the best leads. It's a perfect story for Mamet, who has a great ear for the everyday music of colloquial speech. The film is loaded with wonderful actors, including Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Ed Harris, Alan Arkin, and Alec Baldwin. In this scene, Baldwin plays the no-nonsense boss from company headquarters sent down to chew out the sales team and frighten them into getting fast results.
Put that coffee down. Coffee's for closers only. You think I'm f***ing with you? I am not f***ing with you. I'm here from downtown. I'm here from Mitch and Murray. And I'm here on a mission of mercy. Your name's Levine.
Yeah.
You call yourself a salesman, you son of a b-? I don't gotta listen to this.
You certainly don't, pal. Because the good news is you're fired. The bad news is you've got all you've got just 1 week to regain your job, starting with tonight. Starting with tonight's sit.
Oh, have I got your attention now? Good. Because we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest. As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize is a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired.
James Foley also directed the thrillers At Close Range and After Dark, My Sweet. Terry Gross spoke with Foley in 1992 in front of an audience who had just seen a screening of Glengarry Glen Ross.
When you're directing a movie in which all the actors in it are playing the part of somebody who's very aggressive and in selling, are they that way when you're trying to direct them? Was it intimidating at all because mm-hmm. they're all playing these really manipulative people who have their raps and they have their ways?
No, it was, which has been my experience really on every film, that actors really, really want to be directed and they want interaction.
Even the big stars?
Well, that's what's great is that, doesn't matter who it is, you know, they just, and I really think the best actors, I mean, you know, like Al and the rest of the guys, are so interested in trying anything that they very much want a reaction. Well, and what was interesting, as you said before, is that each person wants that reaction in a different way. I mean, some people don't want you to say certain things, and other people do want you to say certain things. And that's the fun part, is this instinctual idea of figuring out what it is that they need at what time, including sometimes being a little bit, pushing a little bit more than they might want at the time. But there's a mutual understanding of what you're doing.
Who did you push?
Oh, I pushed them all at different times in different ways, you know. But it's just, it's all different how you push them. Because sometimes pushing just means, let's do another take right now really fast. And they go, well, wait. And you say, no, it has to be really fast because, you know, we're really in... And you sort of discombobulate them on purpose because you feel like perhaps we're getting into a kind of a rut and it's getting too precious and people are getting too conscious of what they're saying and you want to. And I've taken to do weird things like, you know, I demand silence all the time from everybody on the crew and everything. And I'm always barking about that. And then I get total silence. And then when it's ready to go, I scream, action, like as loud as I can, which is like really startling. And then the actor's got to start saying his line. But it's sort of like sometimes you see them standing there and they're getting too much into a plan of what they're going to do. And you want them to forget their plan and let whatever happens going to happen. And so it's all different things of doing. I actually threw a fit once, a fake fit, yelling at somebody on the crew just to... get the actors out of their lethargy and change the mood, the electricity on the set.
Was the crew member in on the fact
yes.
that this was a fake fit?
Yes. Yes, I made sure I did that.
So what were you throwing the fit about?
I was throwing the fit about people talking, because I'm famous for throwing fits, real fits, because people will not shut up. So I asked this one guy to talk, right, so then I could turn around and scream at him.
The casting is terrific in the film, but it seems to me you've brought together actors with really different kinds of acting styles. You have Jack Lemmon, who's a kind of like naturalistic actor. And Al Pacino's Al Pacino, you know.
Mm. I was going to sit and wait to hear you get an adjective for each guy.
Yeah. But Ed Harris is kind of chameleon-like in a way, and he can really like blend into a role. But they're, I don't know, like Lemmon's of a different generation than a lot of actors in there, both in terms of his age, but also in terms of his style. And I was wondering if you consciously picked people with different acting styles and what it was like to work with people who, it seems to me, probably take really different approaches to their characters.
Yeah, there was certainly no intention to deliberately pick people with different styles. It was really, I mean, Al and I literally sat down and made a list of who we thought were the best living actors, without even regards to what parts they could play, how old they were. Who do we think is great? And the list isn't that long, you know, when you sit down and just say who's the best. And we started from that idea and wound up with these guys. And it's very true that they all have very different styles of acting. And it was a great fun for me, particularly when they were all in the scene together. And, you know, you say cut, and then you need to go up and speak to each one of them. And I'd find myself instinctually sort of speaking an entirely different language to each one, which was nice, because it made me sort of really expand my own idea of what it means to be a director. And, you know, for me, the most important thing is to do what needs to be done rather than what you want to do.
So you needed to speak a different language to each of the actors?
Totally, yes.
Okay, and so what would you tell Jack Lemmon as opposed to Al Pacino, as opposed
for
to
instance,
Ed Harris?
Jack Lemmon will speak very clearly about the thing, quite literally. The thing being what's going on at the moment that, and perhaps the most telling thing is that when Jack would talk about the character, he would say he would say, I think he's feeling this because of this and blah, 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 and say whole articulate sentences. Al would never speak like that, because first of all, he would say I, referring to something, but he would never talk about any kind of singular idea or notion. And something that I understand very much, because if you articulate a single idea that's happening, then you might try, you know, you might sort of glom onto that in too much of a specific way rather than letting all the contradictions and ambivalences that might naturally come out. So he's very reluctant to identify any one particular feeling, and even reluctant to finish a sentence. But I began to understand very well what he was talking about, and I agreed with him. So our communication was more like him saying, I think, you know, maybe, you know, and I'd say, yeah, right, more so, blah, blah, blah. And we somehow did it, and even to the point where it got to, you know, where once we had done enough takes where we both felt like we really had it, we would always do one crazy one. And that's, we would just call it a crazy one, because to try something just that was a stupid idea, but it's amazing how many of the crazy ones are in there.
Director James Foley, speaking with Terry Gross in 1992. His film Glengarry Glen Ross has just been released on DVD. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with director James Foley. His 1992 film, Glengarry Glen Ross, has just come out on DVD. Let's hear another scene from the film. Al Pacino plays Ricky Roma, a self-assured, charismatic salesman, and the only one of the group who is consistently closing deals and making money. In this scene, he's working a potential customer and won't let go.
You know, they say you don't buy it, you rent it.
Huh?
The thing. You really, what do you keep? I mean, you don't keep anything, really. security. Things, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just, you try to stave off insecurity. You can't do it.
No,
that's what I'm telling you. Stocks, bonds, objects of art, real estate, what are they? An opportunity. To what? To make money? Perhaps. To lose money? Perhaps. To indulge and to learn about ourselves? Perhaps. So what? What isn't? They're an opportunity. That's all they are. They're an event. A guy comes to you, you make a call, you send in a card. I have these properties I would like for you to see. What does this mean? What do you want it to mean? You see what I'm saying? Things happen to you. Glad I met you. I'm glad I met you, James. I want to show you something. It may mean something to you. It may not. I don't know. I don't know anymore. What is that? Florida. Glengarry Highlands. Florida. Bullshit. And maybe that's true. And that's what I said. But look at this. What is this? This is a piece of land. Listen to what I'm going to tell you now.
When you were rehearsing for this, did you bring in any real salesmen to give a sense of how they do it, to talk about their spiels?
Yeah, we did. Somehow somebody dug up a real guy who came in, who was great. He read the script and was thrilled by it and was very proud that we were making a film about him. and he really was very, he was a good sort of visitor because he thought it was very authentic down to every detail, and that gave everybody encouragement. What was interesting about him was that he had no consciousness whatsoever that there was any irony about the situation. He just thought it was a very good story about these guys and showed how sort of clever they were and stuff like that. And he thought it was quite glamorous. And that was very good because the guys at this point during the rehearsals really needed to connect to that, you know, because they needed to, of course, you know, not see anything ironic about it themselves and, you know, let that take care of it and had to become totally, and find some pride in being one of these guys because, you know, they all are, particularly Ricky Roma being the top of the heap, you know, he was very proud, Al, of his pinky ring. He was always looking at it and sort of happy with his suit that cost $2,000 and he would, like, you know, like he does, get into it.
So what did this guy sell who you brought in and why did you bring him in?
To be honest, I don't know where what rock people found him under, but but I know he was real because when I sort of teased him a little bit about perhaps he was, you know, involved in something like, you know, quasi-illegal about maybe what he did in misrepresenting the land, because he had brought himself right up to that point in sort of showing off about how he had really, you know, scammed people and got people to pay much more than the market value of what he was selling. But when I sort of teased him about it, he then got kind of a little bit weird and defensive because all of a sudden he sort of came back to reality and realized that he was like he was feeling very comfortable because the guys were all sort of around him and sort of giving him, and his big movie stars were paying attention to this guy. So he was like saying more than he wanted to, and then all of a sudden he realized how far he was going and he backed up.
So was it useful to have him there?
Yeah, yeah, I think very much. I think if nothing else, to see that a real person existed and that he was, as I say, that he had a sense of real pride in himself.
I wonder if, like, getting assigned to or volunteering to make a movie that you don't really believe in would be the equivalent of what these guys are up against, selling stuff that isn't good.
That's very interesting. I think exactly that. I have thought about that because I had one experience where I did that. And it was hell. I directed an episode of Twin Peaks, and it was in the second season. And they asked me in the first season, and I couldn't do it. So they asked me at the beginning of the second season, and I said yes, and I made this commitment, and thinking it would be like the first season. By the time I got there, David Lynch had totally abandoned the thing. The scripts, he was not putting input into the writing of the script. He was off in Tokyo selling his art. And there I was stuck with this script that had nothing, that was like faux Lynch, you know? It was like a bunch of people sitting around sort of making believe they were David Lynch. And I'm stuck with this script, and it was horrifying. Nothing was more terrible in my life, because you don't know what to do. I don't know where to put the camera. I don't know what to say to the actors. I just want to go home. And it was really, really an awful experience. Luckily, it was only 4 or 5 days, you know, one episode. But it gave me a lesson about that very thing, that there's no way I could get through making a film that I didn't, even if delusional, didn't think had the potential to be good.
Director James Foley speaking in 1992 with Terry Gross about Twin Peaks and about his film Glengarry Glen Ross. The film has a terrific cast, including our next guest, Alan Arkin, who plays a salesman named George. Ed Harris plays Dave, another real estate salesman. And the two of them are so afraid of getting fired that they begin considering desperate measures. Dave hatches a plan to steal the so-called Glengarry leads, the top-secret list of prospects who are the most likely customers to fall for a Florida real estate deal the company is pushing. The leads are locked up in the boss's office, and Dave wants George, played by Arkin, to break in and get them.
Dave.
Yes?
You want me to break into the office tonight and steal the leads?
Yes. Oh, yes, George.
What does that mean?
Listen to this. I have an alibi. I'm going to the Como Inn. Why? Why? The place gets robbed, they're going to come looking for me. Why? Because I probably did it. Now, let me ask you this. Are you going to turn me in?
What if you don't get caught?
They come to you. You're going to turn me in?
Why would they come to me?
They're going to come to everybody.
Why would I do it?
You wouldn't, George. That's why I'm talking to you now. They come to you. You're going to turn me in?
No.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Uh-huh. George, when they come to me, if I have to go in there, and if I get caught, they come to me.
You don't have to go in.
I have to go in, see? That's something I have to do.
Why?
Why? You gonna give me $7,500?
75? I thought we were splitting $5,000.
I lied, all right? Your rent's 25. My end's my own concern. Now, stick with me here, George. They come to me. I'm caught. They're gonna ask me who were accomplices.
Me.
Absolutely.
It's ridiculous.
Well, to the law, you're an accessory before the fact.
I didn't ask to be.
Well, it's tough luck, George, because you are.
Why? Because you just told me about it?
That's right.
Why are you doing this to me, Dave? Why are you talking this way to me? I don't understand. Why are you doing this at all?
It's none of your business, pal. Just in a wrap. You tell me. You're out. You take the consequences.
I do?
That's right.
And why is that?
Because you listened.
Alan Arkin and Ed Harris in a scene from Glengarry Glen Ross. Arkin's other roles include Yossarian in the film version of Catch-22 and the menacing killer in Wait Until Dark. When Terry spoke with Arkin in 1989, she asked him about his first feature film, The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming.
I want to play a short clip from the movie, and this is a scene from early on after the Russians have landed in New England, and you've knocked on the door of a family. Carl Reiner's the husband, Eva Marie Saint is the wife, and you're taking them at gunpoint into their home and hoping that they'll help you find a boat.
All to keep in calm, please. Yes. I repeat, no harm is coming. Olna, please, being seated.
It's all right, honey. Just take it easy now, Pete boy. Don't be scared. There's no need to be scared.
I'm not scared.
Good. Good boy. Now, to answer some few questions very quickly, please, so that there is no necessity whatsoever.
Whatsoever.
So that there is no necessity whatsoever why everybody in such a nice American family should get shot to little pieces. You understand? Yes. Good. Now, what else people are in this house?
So that's your first feature role.
Right.
What stage were you in acting then? How did you prepare for that role?
How did I prepare? It was mostly in learning how to speak Russian and thinking a lot about what I wanted to do. I didn't do any research because I didn't know how I could do any research. I wanted to be very comfortable. It was important to be comfortable. It was my first feature, and I knew I was going to be panic-stricken because it's something I'd wanted to do for 25 years, and it was just too big a hunk of my life to relax about.
So you actually studied Russian for the part?
Yeah, for months. I studied Russian with an old woman in New York. Nobody had told me what to do or how to do it. I was left to my own devices, so I worked for months with this woman trying to get the sound. And I was pretty good at languages, but there were sounds in Russian I could not hear. And then finally, after several months, I began to hear the sounds and I got the lines down in Russian. I went on the set and I said my first line in rehearsals proudly. And there were a lot of real Russians on the set. Nobody understood a word I was saying. And it turned out I was speaking a Russian that no one had spoken for about 50 years. It was totally archaic, and I had to, on the set, start over again from the very beginning, which was very unnerving.
So how much of the Russian do you remember?
I can still say my lines. You can wake me up in the middle of the night, and I can do my lines verbatim, and I can't do it with any other film.
But can you talk to a Russian?
I can say my lines to him from the film.
I'm sure that's a real help.
Yeah.
Alan Arkin speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with actor Alan Arkin.
I have read about you that in the late 60s or early 70s that you started yoga and also found someone who was something of a guru figure for you.
Mm-hmm.
What brought about that change?
What brought about the change was 7 years of analysis in which I worked very hard and which I feel like I really needed. I was very unhappy. And I came to a point where I was coming to the end of my analysis by both my doctor's recognition and my own, and feeling like I'd passed the course, and having him say akin to, I never promised you a rose garden. And I found myself getting furious at that idea because I saw that there were people that had rose gardens, and I wanted one. And if analysis wasn't going to do it for me, particularly since I had worked very, very hard at it, and had accomplished a lot of what my doctor felt was to be accomplished from it, I felt like I had to look elsewhere. And I started working with somebody who turned out, who I knew immediately was the best person I had ever met. He was the wisest and kindest person I'd ever met. And initially, I didn't know he was a yogi. He was my stand-in on a film, on Poppy. And
he was playing an extra, or so? He was playing a stand-in.
He was my stand-in, which is not a terribly exalted job, mm-hmm. as everybody knows. And after about 3.5 weeks, I could sense very clearly that he was the center of the entire film. It's not as if he was loud or pushy or taking over anything, but he just radiated something that people gravitated towards. Like one person would be telling him their problems, another person would be asking him for a massage. And I got really quietly enraged by that. And it was, again, nothing that he was attempting to do. He wasn't attempting to run the show in any way. It was very quiet. And if you didn't really look for this, you wouldn't have even noticed it. And it annoyed me. So I said, here I am. I have everything. I'm the star. I got 10 times as much money as he's got. I got more attention. And he's the center of this thing. It's not right. So I tried to find out who and what he was, and he finally revealed the fact that he was a guru. Has got a terribly convoluted connotations this day. We've twisted around and almost destroyed the meaning of that word. Everybody who knows something is now called a guru, which is not what the word means by any stretch of the imagination. It means slayer of darkness, which is ultimately what analysis tries to do and doesn't do. It knocks off a piece of it, but it doesn't get the whole thing. And a great spiritual teacher knocks off your darkness, which is the thing that is keeping you from functioning fully and wholly and completely and lovingly.
Can I relate this back to acting and ask you if it's changed the way you act or changed how much you act or the kinds of roles you take?
Yeah, to a degree. It depends on how much money I've got in the bank, in part.
I mean, sure.
If I'm feeling pretty flushed, then I feel more comfortable in turning down things that I don't want to do. But if I'm behind a payment on the house, then I got to be a little bit more generous in my assessment of something. But yeah, I don't want to play horrible people anymore. I don't want to. It's no fun. There was a time when I had so little sense of myself that getting out of my skin and being anybody else was a sigh of relief. But I kind of like myself now a lot of the times, and I don't see any real necessity or value in playing people that I find abhorrent anymore. That's number one. And number two, I like to think if I possibly can be in situations like it, I want my work to be connected with things that somehow serve people in some way.
Alan Arkin, speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. He appears in the 1992 film Glengarry Glen Ross, which has just been released on DVD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
December 25.
Okay, Donner, Cupid ain't coming. You better drive straight so Santa don't vomit. Every single year, he drills the same, and he calls them all by name. A little bit of Rudolph lights the way. A little bit of Prancer, she's so gay. A little bit of Cupid with his bow. A little bit of Vixen, she's a ho, ho, ho. A little bit of Blitzen at the pub. A little bit of Comet, he's my tub. A little bit of Dasher, he's so fun. All the reindeer get it done. December 25.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sugar Association, educating consumers about sugar. Sugar, the natural sweetener, 15 calories per teaspoon, on the web at sugar.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet singer-songwriter Brian Ferry. His most recent album is called Frantic. Ferry was one of the original members of the group Roxy Music. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
My sun is set, but my day is done. When I turn to the east, I can see no one.